Now, let's get back to Just Love and your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. Happy New Year. We began with that song because in just a few moments, we're going to be speaking with Kathy Mattea, who is a Grammy Award-winning American country music singer, and that was one of her more popular songs that she's sung. So I'm delighted that she's going to be a guest in a few moments. Happy New Year to everybody. Hope that it was a very blessed New Year, very blessed Christmas season. And we continue. As we know, we're still in the Christmas season, even though I was disappointed when I kind of came into our studios here in New York that all of the Christmas decorations are down. And that's wrong because there are at least 12 days of Christmas, and that goes to the Feast of the Epiphany, which is next week, and that kind of we take it down so soon. I mean, we've begun putting them up after Labor Day, so I mean, we could at least keep them up for a little bit longer than just a week. I mean, so anyway, but I'm delighted with our show today as we begin the new year that we're going to be speaking with Kathy Mattea, and why don't we go to her right now. She is a Grammy Award-winning American country music songwriter and performer. She just released her 18th album titled Pretty Bird, and we're going to be speaking with her about that album and her own personal journey. Kathy Mattea, thanks for joining us on Just Love.
My pleasure. Glad to be here with you.
Wow, you don't have a New York accent.
I don't have a New York accent, but interestingly, I don't have a West Virginia accent either, particularly. I think it's just from years of living with people from all over, it's sort of fallen away a little bit.
Well, you know, I got to tell you a little secret, Kathy. We New Yorkers, we're the only people in the country without an accent. The rest of you guys all have accents.
Whatever you say, it's your show, I will go with the flow.
So listen, let me just tell you a little bit of a personal. I am just so thrilled that you agreed to be on our show today as we kind of begin the new year. I was really privileged to hear you perform, many, many years ago, when you performed at a Campaign for Human Development event in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. I remember this.
Yeah, it was a wonderful, wonderful concert. Was it at the Navy Pier?
It was at Navy Pier, and I can remember it was put together by someone who became a bit of a mentor for me, a Jesuit priest named Joe Hakala. And he put it on, and I remember walking out. It was mostly bishops, and I was like, I just remember the moment. I remember is not only how much fun it was and how lovely the audience was, but I just remember walking out and going, oh, thank God. I just thought you might all have your miters on and no one would be able to see me for all the hats.
But they didn't. They didn't.
No, they didn't. It was great.
It was wonderful. It was really what I think is Father Joe Hackle, was he also from West Virginia?
Yes, he was. We were from the same hometown.
Ah, okay. That's.
And I sang in his funeral in D.C.
How long ago did he pass away?
Gosh, it's been quite a few years now. And it was you know, a very kind of rare leukemia-like blood disease. And but we got to spend some great time together before. I saw him a couple of times while his health was still good, and just had some great long talks and made some really good memories. And I just feel really lucky to have had him in my life.
Well, I worked with him on the Campaign for Human Development, mm-hmm. and just such a kind of wonderful, wonderful person with a real kind of real sense of stuff, and I just thought it was great. So I was delighted when I heard the song that you just have redone, Mercy Now. Can we listen to the first verse of verse of that? Great.
My father could use a little mercy now. Fruits of his labor fall and rot slowly on the ground. His work is almost over. It won't be long. He won't be around. I love my father. He could use some mercy now.
So, Kathy, tell me, that is just such a beautiful song. It was written by Mary Gauthier. Is that her
name? Gauthier.
Did she write both the melody and the words?
Yes, and her version of it is very different. It's been an interesting journey with this song. It's sort of like I encapsulated everything about music that I've ever experienced in one song and one recording. Mary wrote this song years ago, and I knew about it, and it kind of came back around to my attention in a conversation with someone. And I, you know, in these crazy times that we're living in, I just started listening to it a few times a day, and I just found solace in this song again. And I thought, oh my gosh, I mean, this song is so different than anything I've ever done, but if I can learn to sing this song and own it as my own, I get to do it every day. I get to sing it every night.
So I'm going to tell you a little bit of a secret. It's when I go to the gym,
yeah,
for the past month or so, this is one of the things that I listen to, and it times very well with a particular piece of the exercise that I do. It's kind of like perfect.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, so it's a great, great song. So let me go back to that question. So you said there are different versions of it, mm-hmm, different words or different melody?
The melody is the same, the words are the same, but the approach is different. Like when Mary sings it, it's sort of like a very conversational folk song.
Okay.
When I worked with Bill Cooley, who's been my guitarist forever, and we sat in the living room for 6 months working on this, and he kind of took the chords to a more gospel-y place, and I was approaching it more like a prayer or more like a hymn. So it's a completely, in fact, one of my friends heard me sing it, one of our mutual friends, Mary and my mutual friends, heard me sing it recently, and she was like, I thought, I know this song, but I've never heard this song before. And she said it was so different, she didn't recognize it. And, you know, this is Mary Gauthier's, she's a songwriter here in Nashville. She's very well respected, and it's her signature song. And I've always been of the conviction that if you're going to tackle something that's so identified with another person, you have to bring something of yourself. You have to transform it into something that you own in your own way.
So, you know, when I was in high school, I had a teacher who taught me something really, really valuable that I've taken with me all these years. He said, you really don't have to be that smart as an original, but you got to be smart enough to steal only the good stuff.
Yes, I think of it as filtering that through my own persona, my own personal flavor, and seeing if it comes out different. Yeah, you know, seeing if it comes out different enough that it adds something, that it's worth putting out into the world. And, you know, for me too, there's been this big shift in this polarization that everybody's talking about and all of that. And I thought, well, as an artist, what do you want to spend your time singing every day? And what do you want to put out in the world? What kind of conversation do you want to start? Do you want to start an I'm angry conversation? Do you want to start a they're wrong and here's why conversation? Or do you want to talk about mercy? Do you want to talk about grace? Do you want to talk about how to be more open to each other? And what can I do to send people home thinking about that in the middle of all of this?
Well, you know, when you said, Kathy, that the words have remained the same, the melodies have remained, but the take on it's been different, I'd like to listen to the third the third stanza of this, because I just said, well, that had to be written within the past year or so, but you're telling me, no, this was written...
This song is 15 or 20 years old.
Right, so let's listen to that third verse.
Okay.
My church and my country could use a little mercy now. As they sink into a poison pit, it's gonna take forever to climb out. They carry the weight of the faithful who follow them down. they could use some mercy now.
I got to tell you, that verse sends just chills up and down my spine. I mean, it couldn't be more, and I think you're right, that prayer or lament or whatever it is just couldn't be more on target.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I told Mary I was going to record the song, I was like, look, I recorded your song last week. She just gave me a sideways glance. She just kind of looked at me like I had two heads. And she was like, really? I said, yeah. She said, did you do the church and country verse? I said, yeah. She said, no one who's ever recorded it has done the church and country verse except Mary herself.
Really?
And I have to tell you, I've stood on stage and sung that for people who don't know the song. And I've done it all over the country in many, you know, blue states, red states, all kinds of mixed crowds. I don't know who's in my crowd, who's liberal and who's conservative or whatever people might be bringing to the party. And I get a little nervous when I start that, but I try to keep my heart open when I'm singing it. And to me, the brilliant thing about the songwriting in this part is that she says, I love my church and country. I love them.
Yep.
I'm not here pointing a finger. I love them. It's about grief, and it's about how do you resolve what seems to be unresolvable. How do you have hard conversations? And to me, that's what's going to lead us to a better conversation. And I love having that little moment of, I love you guys. I love us. I am part of us. And we all need mercy.
Well, you know, it's I'm old and decrepit enough that I kind of came of age during the Vietnamese War. And some of the divisiveness and some of the anger and some of the casting aspersions on the motives and of others is to me reminiscent of that. And I was right in the middle of that. And I mean, I have no hesitant to say, I mean, I'm so fickle and feeble-minded that one year I marched down Fifth Avenue in New York in favor of the war in Vietnam, and another year I walked down against the war. I mean, I took both sides of that issue. So whenever they say politicians are fickle, I say, hey, wait a minute. That just means you changed your mind and maybe you listened to some more facts whichever way you went. So, but the divisiveness that was then is very, very similar to the divisiveness that is now. But I mean, I have my own theory as to why it's a little bit different and to some extent a little bit worse now. And to me, I think it's got to do with 24/7 news cycles, and it's got to do with social media, because so little is vetted anymore. It's just whatever spills out of your gut now becomes in the public arena.
Yes. And so, you know, for me, I thought, okay, you know, you either say, I'm not going to be political, or you say, I'm just not going to address it, I'm just going to do fun music, or you say, what do I want to spend my time singing about? What is important to me? Like, what feels, what do I want to put out in the world? And so one of the things that I do that song, and I don't say much before it, I just kind of let the song speak for itself, and then at the end of the night, there's another song I've done for years that's about how, you know, the pendulum swings one way, the pendulum swings the other, but underneath it, there's this grounding force that is always home, that is always there. And then I get people singing, and I talk about how when we're singing, we don't know who the person next to us voted for, and we don't care. Singing unifies us in our bodies, and we're literally resonating with each other, and we're literally like, we take all our voices and we make one voice. And that's the last thing I do before I send people out in the world. And it's like, that gives me, like, that's what makes me pack my bags and get on the bus, you know? That's what I want to spend my time doing.
Well, and I think this song does it. And what I love about the song is, you know, nobody's excluded. And my dad, who was just a simple working class guy, not like today, he came back from World War II, went to work for one company and retired like 35 years later from the same company. And he got a decent job, but he never became an executive. He, you know, we never went hungry. He supported us, but it wasn't a really high class job. But what he would always say about kind of sermons is you know, the two things I don't like about sermons when I go to church. One is, if it's always about you and they're always pointing fingers, I don't like that. And the other thing I don't like, if they kind of are reading it, it means it's not important enough for them to remember how they expect me to remember it when I leave it. So what I'd like to do is listen to the last clip, because I think, you know, okay, father, brother, church, country, every living thing. But then in the last one, I think it's just what brings it all together.
We all could use a little mercy now. I know we don't deserve it, but we need it anyhow. We hang in the balance, dangle between hell and hallowed ground. Oh, every single one of us could use some mercy now. Yeah.
That's just so beautiful that it really is about all of us. We all could use some mercy.
Yeah, and what I love about the brilliant writing in this song is that she doesn't say, oh, we're all broken.
Right.
She doesn't say, oh, we're all flawed. We're just pieces of, you know, we're all just sinners. She basically just says, oh, this is just how it is. This is part of being human. We don't have to work for this. This is part of the way it is. You find your flaws, you grieve them, you pray, you open up, and something comes in that's bigger than you. And that's the thing. And to me, it's a missing piece in the conversation that, you know, I have to remember that there's something bigger than me at work here. Our culture is just so like, there's a problem, let's fix it. Who's to blame and what do we do and how do we fix it and what's the answer? But sometimes I have to live in the question for a while before I find the answer.
Well, it takes a while sometimes. It doesn't. And, you know, I think it's interesting what I've often said, that the verse there, my church and my country sink into, it's going to take forever to climb out. And I mean, I've said recently about particularly my Catholic Church, is that, you know, there's no silver bullet to deal with the issue of what my fellow clergy and there's no silver bullet. It's not a statement. It's not one thing. It's we're going to have to live with the darkness and kind of walk and do good in the midst of the darkness. And hopefully, as you say, it's going to take a while to climb out of this, this poison pit. It's not like a quick fix with regard to things.
Yeah, and there's that paradox there of, like, you know, you have to bring that darkness into the light in order to find a way, and that's the challenge. You know, it's really excruciating. Can we, you know, be lanced open and sit in that excruciating pain? To be able to, I mean, that's, you know, that's part of the healing process. And I did that whole death and resurrection, that sort of, like, you know, I'm irreparably broken. And that is, admitting that is like the beginning of finding your way to how it heals. And it's just, to me, maybe it's just because I'm about to turn 60. And so I'm just sort of thinking.
You're a youngin, because I'm 68. So.
Well, it just seems to be a theme that's playing out in this season of my life. And you see what's falling away and you see what's coming to fruition, too.
So we're speaking with Kathy Mateo, who is a songwriter, performer. She's Grammy Award-winning singer. Kathy, you went through a little trauma in your life a while ago. You want to talk a little bit about that, when you had questions about your voice?
Oh, yeah. During the last 3-4 years, I hit when menopause was over, my voice got kind of wonky. And the short version of the story is just that I didn't know if it was like the beginning of the end of my ability to sing, or if it was just something I needed to work through. And at my first thought, you know, there was a part of me that just panicked and thought, well, I'll just phase out. I'll just quit. And I was like, well, you know, this is like the biggest gift of your life, getting to do this. It's okay to quit, but you can't quit until you know. You can't just quit because you're scared that you can't sing. You got to find out if you can sing or not before you can make a full decision about it. And so I found a voice teacher. I had had one for a long time, but she was getting older and her health was declining, so I had to find a new teacher. And I just dug in, and I took weekly lessons, and I practiced every day, and then I'd sit with my guitar player, Bill, all afternoon one day a week, and we'd just sing through all kinds of stuff. And some days it would just soar, and some days it would be like I hadn't learned to sing, like I hadn't. And it felt like I had to relearn to sing from scratch with a new instrument after, like, you know, 40 years of singing the same way.
And apparently you had a chance encounter, or maybe not chance, with Tony Bennett?
Yes. Well, that's part of what happened. I had this random conversation one time. I was in a room with Tony Bennett, and we were both in the corner of this big gathering. And I thought, oh, I've got him all to myself. What do you want to ask him? So I said, hey, can I ask you a question? He said, sure. I said, I heard you sing tonight. And he was in his late 70s at that point. I heard you sing tonight, and I know how old you are. How did you do that? How do you do that? And he just smiled, and he said, well, my voice isn't what it once was, but it's a lot better than it was a couple years ago. And he said, I found a teacher, and I started digging in, and I started working again. And I thought, if Tony Bennett can do that in his late 70s, I can do this in my 50s.
Well, you know, I never was a big, big Tony Bennett fan. Never had anything against him, but I just was never a big fan. But now he's gone up in my book because of that encounter with you, and I got to confess that he actually sang with Lady Gaga. So I figured he can't be all bad. If he helped you and he sung with Lady Gaga, it's
yeah.
Whatever. So tell
yeah,
me.
I went to hear him last year. He was 90.
Wow.
I could not believe. At one point, he put down the microphone and sang Fly Me to the Moon just in the room. And I just broke over sobbing. I just started sobbing.
So I don't know how this music business works, but is your song Mercy Now, is that going to be up for any awards, or could it be up for awards?
Well, I think that it's lovely, and a lot of people are talking about it, and it's beautiful. But it's very, very difficult these days to surface with enough attention. People tend to sort of have little pockets these days. And so I don't have any big expectations about it. It would be a lovely thing. And I do think it's one of the better things I've sung in my life. And that was enough satisfaction in itself. And my philosophy about it is I do what feels fulfilling to me, and then I sort of let the chips fall where they fall. So
now, what genre is it? I don't even know.
Well, that's another question. I think these days they would call it Americana,
okay,
which is sort of roots music, or what we would think of as like folk, or has elements of blues and country and roots music, basically.
Okay, but you know what? I confess, I'm tone deaf. I don't play any musical instruments, but I love listening to music, and I know, and I'm a little bit eclectic, because that is a great. I mean, this to me, that is a great song, but there's also some of the stuff which is kind of, you know, bubblegum pop, which I think there's some deep messages in that too. And it just seems to me that what you just said, a few minutes ago, is that music is, and not to be trite, but it's one of those things that kind of unites us. In other words, you know, it pulls us together in a way, and that is just a gift, and I am so glad that you didn't kind of just fade off into the sunset.
Thank you. I've been really lucky, because people early in my career when I was young just said, you know, basically pointed me towards like listening to what fulfills me about it, and not really worrying too much about the commercial aspect of it, and that has served me well. I still feel, you know, awake and alive in it, and excited to sing at 60 years old. And, you know, that's it's a lot better to me than like making it really big for a few years and then burning out. You know, it's sustained me for my whole life. Music has. And,
well, Kathy Mantea, thank you for being so generous with your time, being with us on Just Love, and thanks for being with us. And let's go out with just talking about Every Little Thing Being Mercy. Thanks so much for being with us on Just Love.
Thank you very much, Monsignor. Right. It's been a pleasure.
Right.
Every living thing could use a little mercy now. Of grace, and in the race toward another mushroom cloud, and the people in power, they'll do anything to keep their crowd. Oh, I love life and life itself. Use some mercy now.
Now, let's get back to Just Love and your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world, and we reflect upon what's going on in the world through our Catholic social values. We say, just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. So one of the things I thought we would do as we begin a new year is to kind of think about our social values, and we kind of categorize them into seven different values: the life and dignity of the human person. We talk about family, community, and participation. We talk about rights and responsibilities. And we talk about the option for the poor and the vulnerable, the dignity of work and the rights of workers, solidarity, and care of God's creation. Now, we're not going to have the solution to all of these, but I thought that it might be valuable to just think about how each of those areas was an area in which there were some important issues that were raised during the past year, events that caused us to reflect on them. And, you know, one of the ones that was a little bit disturbing to me was this Chinese researcher claiming that he created the first gene-edited baby, twin girls that were born not too long ago. And he said that he was able to alter some genetic DNA and create these two twins. And now that's kind of banned in the United States. And some think it's a really, really dangerous thing to engage in. And, you know, obviously from our Catholic perspective, that is really a very, very troubling thing. And, you know, I see it's banned in the United States, but I'm of the opinion that unfortunately we're in the mode where it's hard to ban something you can do, so that we take the position as, well, if it can be done, well, let's give it a try. So that's one of the things that is worth reflecting on, the life and the dignity of a human person. We did talk about another item we talked about on the show, the fact that traditionally one of the most Catholic countries in the world, Ireland, by a 2-1 majority, voted to legalize abortion. And so those are two issues which are really kind of important for us to reflect upon based upon our belief in the life and the dignity of the human person. You know, when it comes to the call to family, community, and participation, one of the things that we participate is in voting. And, you know, if we think about the United States, in the United States, in the most recent election, in which there was a lot of enthusiasm in 2016, only about 55% of the voting age population voted, compared with Australia. In their most recent election, they had like 78% of the country that voted. In Israel had 76% that voted. And so we're kind of down near the bottom of the voting percentages. And so that's, we need to reflect upon that from our Catholic position of, you know, we're supposed to participate in public debates. So when it comes to the third area, rights and responsibilities, one of the things that was a long debate this past year was renewing the Farm Bill. And the Farm Bill contains in it food stamps, supplemental nutrition assistance for people who are of limited income, so they get more ability to buy nutritious food for their families. And one of the big debates was there is, well, what are we going to do about requirements that they're responsible to do something for it? And this is a little technical, because there always have been work requirements. And this change was to maybe make the details a little bit more explicit and to make them, as many said, more onerous. And so that issue, which we debated about, well, should there be those new restrictions, was an issue about the responsibility that people had to kind of provide for themselves if they were receiving some assistance so that they could have the right to enough food. So that was one of the issues. You know, we've talked about the fourth area, option for the poor and the vulnerable, and it goes through a lot of things. But again, sadly, we've talked about it before, but among the most vulnerable are refugees and displaced persons, of which there are close to 70 million in the world. About 2/3 of those are displaced within their own country, and another third of them, you know, 23, 24 million, have crossed borders because of fear, persecution, famine, drugs, violence in their own countries. And so that's a very, very important area. You know, when we talk about the rights of workers and the dignity of work, there was a very important Supreme Court decision which was very controversial, because it dealt a blow to unions collecting mandatory fees. And the Supreme Court ruled that workers who didn't want to participate didn't have to contribute to that. Now, that's a very simplistic way of doing it. It was a very, very important decision, and that's just the capture of the highlight of that. And the sixth area is that of solidarity. You know, that we live in one world, and this past year has kind of witnessed a thrust towards a little bit less solidarity, or a lot less solidarity, and a little bit more going it alone. So Brexit, in which Great Britain decided that they were going to pull out of the European Union, was an indication of moving in another direction. The debate about NAFTA and ending that agreement between Canada and Mexico and the United States, and the non-implementation of the Trans-Pacific Pact, so that there is a tendency in the world we're seeing kind of moving in the opposite direction of solidarity. And some of the debates about what's going on in the UN and how much we're going to participate, this United States is one of those. And the final area, the care of creation. Well, the past year, there's been a lot of debates about the standards in our own country on environmental issues such as emissions. And there's been, you know, a pullback of some of the previous protections that were there with the argument that they don't do much good. And then we had the California fires and the volatility that is there. So care for God's creation was on the agenda of our country for the past year. So I thought we'd just kind of review our seven kind of principles and values of Catholic social teaching and see that those do impact how we think about certain issues that are, you know, part of our public policy debate. You know, they don't give us all the answers, but they do give us a perspective by which we think about them. So let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to be speaking about peace. We're going to speak about the World Day of Peace message, but we're going to be speaking with Dr. Lori Nathan, who deals in mediation at the Kroc Institute at Notre Dame. This is Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just. It will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
One, two, three, four.
Just do it. Just love. Just check out Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, who's here right now. Take it away, Monsignor.
Remember those walls I built. Welcome back to Just Love. This is our weekly conversation about what's going on in the world, and we look at them through the prism of our Catholic social values. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, and as we begin the new year, We're thinking about a variety of things, and one of the things we're thinking about is that each year the Pope issues a proclamation on World Day of Peace, and we're thinking about the new year and how it can be more peaceful, and I'm just delighted that we have a guest in our studio here. I'm delighted he came in, Dr. Lawrence Nathan, who is a South African national, but he is now at the mediation program and its director and a professor of the practice of mediation at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Dr. Nathan, thanks so much for joining us on Just Love.
It's a great pleasure. Happy to be with you.
Well, and we're glad that you made it here to New York. Do I detect a non-Bronx accent?
Well, I'm a native of Cape Town in South Africa, so that's the explanation for the accent.
That's far away, isn't it?
Yeah, although in the modern world, we're just a kind of blink and email away.
Well, that's true. Tell our listeners who are throughout the United States, how long does it take to fly to Cape Town from, let's say, New York?
It's about a 14-hour flight, and you can fly direct from Johannesburg to New York.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's about the same to go to Australia, isn't it?
I've not been to Australia from New York. I think that might be a little longer.
I think you're right. I think it's about 17 hours from New York to Australia. But listen, thank you so much for coming here to be with us. You know, in the Pope's World Day of Peace message talks about how politics and the organization of that does have a good impact, does have an impact on peace or less peace in a world. I'm intrigued because the mediation program, I suspect, at its core says there's a different way that to resolve conflict than simply by shooting each other.
Mm. Yeah, right. That's putting it mildly.
Right.
You know, we say that conflict is normal, it's natural, it is not inherently destructive or inherently violent. Wherever you have groups of people with different values and interests, there's bound to be some form of conflict. But we can manage conflict in different ways. We can manage it peacefully or we can manage it violently. And if we want to manage it without resort to violence, then we have to be willing to accommodate difference. We have to be tolerant of our opponents. We have to look for outcomes that are mutually beneficial rather than outcomes that are win-lose, where we seek to win and our opponent or enemy loses everything.
So, Dr. Nathan, I mean, you've been doing this for a little while, right? And you also have done some work in Africa, haven't you, in the Sudan?
That's right. I used to head a center for conflict resolution in Cape Town. We did mediation in our city and a country, as well as elsewhere on the continent. I was involved with the African Union mediation for Darfur 2005-2006, which was in the midst of a rebellion, civil war, and genocide. Recently, I was working with the South Sudan Council of Churches in Juba, doing training for them in mediation skills.
So, Dr. Nathan, let's talk a little bit, because we've had some guests on our show here on Just Love over the years talking about the Sudan. So tell our listeners throughout the country who are probably not as up on this as you are, because there was an election in the Sudan, and there's I'm just being very simple, and you're going to correct all my mistakes on this, where there was a lot of oil in the south, but they couldn't do anything with it because they had all the factories up in the north, and they had to decide who was getting which amount of money and things like that, and they had a vote, and etc. So give our listeners like the 2-minute history of the Sudan in the past 5 years.
Right, so here we go. Sudan is a country in Africa, north and east. It is an enormous country that experienced a civil war for over 2 decades, leading to 1.5 million people dead.
Wow.
And the struggle was between a fairly brutal and authoritarian Islamic ruling party that discriminated against and marginalized just about everybody else in the country, including those in the south of Sudan, who were not Muslim and who objected to tyrannical rule from the north.
Right.
And they rose in rebellion, leading to this brutal civil war, which ended in 2005 through a comprehensive peace agreement with a regional mediator. So this was an example of successful mediation. part of the agreement provided that the South could have a referendum to determine whether they wished to be independent or not. The referendum took place. The vote was overwhelmingly
in
favor.
What year was that referendum?
2010-11. Okay. And the vote was overwhelmingly in favor of independence. And as a result, we had the birth of a new country in Africa, South Sudan. A high level of optimism and positive spirit, new country being born, and it wasn't long before it plunged itself into a civil war.
Now, let me ask you a question, Dr. Nathan, because I think when that election took place, at least if I remember correctly from one of the guests we had on our show, there was a little bit sitting on pins and needles as to whether the North was going to respect the vote.
That's quite right.
In the South. And at least initially, it went maybe better than most people kind of were expecting, at least initially. Is my memory right?
That's quite correct. And I've just done research on exactly this question. There was an expectation that the government of Sudan would either not allow the referendum to go ahead or would reject a vote in favor of secession.
Right.
And there was incredible behind-the-scenes preventive diplomacy work undertaken by the African Union, former President Thabo Mbeki in particular, and by the United Nations through their envoys, that convinced the President of Sudan, President Bashir, to let the referendum go ahead and accept the results.
We're speaking with Dr. Lawrence Nathan, who is the Mediation Program Director and Professor of Practice of Mediation at the Kroc Institute of the University for Notre Dame. And we're speaking about the Sudan, which he is quite familiar with. So we had a good beginning. So what went wrong?
The short answer is greed.
Ah.
Greed and ego. The division that leading to a civil war in South Sudan has not been based on ideological grounds, nor on the basis of a fight between governments and a liberation movement, but rather it's been based on a split within the ruling party. SPLM, standing for the South, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement. So the ruling party split, and it split on grounds.
The ruling party in the South.
Correct.
Okay. Right.
That split on grounds of ego and fighting over the spoils of oil. So it was venal and corrupt, and that made it harder to resolve through mediation because where parties are fighting on ideological grounds, it's quite clear what they stand for. Whereas if they're fighting over the spoils, then basically that's the effort during negotiations to see how to divvy up the resources of the country.
So the issue was not so much a fighting between the North and the South, but within the South.
Correct. So you have a reproduction of what was once a war between the North and the South into a war within the South.
So, as you said, that when it's about greed and when it's about ego, that's more difficult to deal with from a mediation point of view than when it's on ideology.
I think it is. As a mediator, one wants to know where the parties stand clearly so that you can ascertain areas of common ground and areas of difference. And then you seek to enlarge the areas of common ground and minimize the areas of difference. That's more difficult when it's all personalized.
Ah, so what's the current situation there?
It's an unstable peace.
Okay.
It's a situation of no war, no peace. Large parts of the country are relatively quiet, but some are still involved in fighting. And this is because one of the factions has refused to sign the most recent peace agreement brokered by an organization called IGAD, which stands for the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, being the regional body in the Horn of Africa.
Right. Now, I think, Professor Nathan, if you ask the ordinary people, and I judge ordinary people by people you do in taxi bars or people you meet in bars or people you meet at sports events, and you kind of, if you're having a conversation, I think most of them would just say, hey, this mediation stuff, you know, it's nice talk, but like guns are what do it and bombs are what do it and all of those things. That's what really gets people to pay attention. Mm-hmm. But you've been doing this and it's got to work in some cases. So tell us about some of the things that have actually worked with regard to this mediation that you can point to as success.
There was a brutal civil war in Mozambique that ended through mediation. There was civil strife in Zimbabwe that ended through mediation. There was...
So give us the years on those.
Zimbabwe, remember, Zimbabwe was former White Rhodesia,
okay.
Ruled by a white minority regime, confronted by two black African liberation movements. In 1979, the British government mediated a resolution of that conflict
right.
at a place called Lancaster House, and it became known as the Lancaster House Peace Agreement.
Right.
Mozambique fought against Portuguese colonial rule, became independent, and then entered into a civil war against the rebel movement known as RENAMO. A Catholic lay community known as San Egidio was the mediator. The mediation happened right. in Rome with the support of the Italian government and the U.S. government, and led to the Rome Agreement, which brokered peace in Mozambique, ending a decade-long civil war. Throughout the world, there have been successful mediations that end wars between countries and within countries. The bottom line, however, from a mediator's perspective, and I say this to the folk in the pub, it works if the conflict parties want to end the conflict.
Right.
But they hate each other so much and mistrust each other so much that they need an impartial third party to help them.
Right.
If the parties believe they're going to win and they are bent on destruction, there's nothing that mediators can do to stop that happening.
So my next question you've just answered. So my next question was, if we kind of moved off this broad international issue, and I think if we look at our own country, while at the moment we don't have a violent civil war, but I listen to enough news to know that when I listen to the right-wing Freedom Caucus and I listen to the Democratic Socialists, which are they got a few more members now, we're living in different worlds. When I listen to them, do the techniques of mediation, can any of that be used in this situation?
The answer is yes, but it's a qualified yes, because there's a huge distinction between adversarial politics and violent politics.
Okay.
And in a democracy, we tolerate adversarial politics, provided it isn't violent. And it's in the nature of a democracy that political parties contest their views, sometimes quite vociferously. And they're entitled to freedom of speech and freedom of association and freedom of protest. So one can't seek to crack down on lawful, legitimate politics, however ugly or adversarial it may seem to be. We want to prevent and end violence when violence occurs. Nonetheless, mediation can apply to adversarial, nonviolent politics where one seeks common ground, because that's a functional, effective, and legitimate way of resolving problems in the interests of citizens.
So might I suggest that with regard to mediation, international, wherever, whatever the situation is, I'm willing to bet that part of the mediator's job is to get both sides to come to a consensus on, quote unquote, the facts, what reality is.
Well, yeah, of course. And the parties view reality utterly differently. So it's not simply that right. they disagree on values or interests, they disagree on the facts, and they right. disagree on the history of those facts.
So that it seems to me, internationally, when you do have the violent conflict, you're trying to deal with creating a fact-based consensus or whatever that can be a basis for resolving things, I assume.
Well, I think from a mediator's perspective, we're more interested in brokering agreement on the future
okay.
than on the past.
Okay.
In my own country, in South Africa, for example, in the run-up to our ending apartheid, I was involved in bringing soldiers together, generals, from the Liberation Army and the Apartheid Army. They disagreed bitterly on the causes of the conflict and who had done worse to whom. We were saying as mediators, we can't manage the past. We can and have to manage the future.
Okay.
So why don't we try and formulate a common vision of defense in the new South Africa? And that proved easier than reaching agreement on the ugly history of the country.
Hey, Professor Nathan, thank you so much for being with us. I learned a whole lot. And I learned a lot about the Sudan, learned a lot about the examples of success that are there. And I just want to wish you the best in your your work, because it's a critically, critically important thing. So thank you so much for joining us on Just Love as we begin the new year.
Monsignor Sullivan, thank you. And Happy New Year to you and your guests.
Thank you. What I do want to share with our listeners is that as we begin the new year, we begin with feasts of two people who are not so well known in our Western Church, but in the Eastern Church, they are. St. Basil and St. Gregory Nazianzen, whose feast day we celebrated earlier this week. And I'd like to leave you with just a little bit of their writings, because I think it's a nice way to begin the new year. St. Basil wrote, "The bread which you use is the bread of the hungry. The garment hanging in your wardrobe is the garment of him who is naked. The shoes you do not wear are the shoes of the one who is barefoot. The acts of charity that you do not perform are so many injustices that you commit." I just think that is a beautiful, beautiful way. And St. Gregory said something similar but very different. "Let us not become evil stewards of the goods which were given to us. Let's not strive to treasure and store up things while others are suffering from hunger. After the transgression, the human race was separated and avarice cut up the nobility of nature. Help nature. Honor the form of freedom. Show respect to yourself. Assist in illness. Help in one's need. Let us imitate the highest and chief law of God, who sends rain to the just and the unjust, and dawns the sun also for everyone." I think that's a nice way to begin our new year. A blessed new year to all of you. And thanks for joining us on Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about our Catholic social values in light of what's going on in the world. The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.